This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Allison Gash and Dan Tischner to talk about their new book, Democracy's Child, Young People and the Politics of Control, Leverage, and Agency. This book was published by Oxford University Press in 2022, and it is a really compelling analysis and investigation of how we think about young people within our democracy and the fact that they are often excluded from the studies of democracy, which is really important to understand. So I'm going to ask Allison and Dan to tell us a little bit about themselves and how they came to this project that is, in fact, quite fascinating. Hi, Allison. Hi, Dan.
Hey. Thanks for having us, Lily.
Yeah, thanks for having us. This is great.
So I wanted to ask you about, you know, who you are, where you are, and how the two of you came to this project together.
Okay, so we are both at the University of Oregon, and I am a U.S. politics scholar who focuses in the area of American political development. I do lots of work on immigration and immigrant rights, and also on social movements and presidents and political parties, so political institutions, movements, and certain areas of public policy. And I could say so much more, but I'm going to hand the baton to Allison.
This is Allison, and I focus mostly on studying social policy through the realm of public law, mostly. And focusing quite a bit on gender, race, and then especially with respect to young people with LGBTQ rights. My last book focused quite a bit on same-sex marriage and same-sex parenting, and focused a lot on the ways in which young people were deployed in those particular debates.
And both of you are seasoned scholars, and so you have, you know, lots of work in your sort of own realms, but this project brought you together, and you've been very excited about it. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, how you came together on this project and how it turned out.
Yes, yeah, so this is like an incredibly happy story of two colleagues who have offices across the hall from each other. Who just like are really good friends and love talking about stuff that we as political scientists always love chatting about. And there was one day where, I'd say a couple things. One day where we were just talking about how much we thought about children and children's rights from grad school. And so like, I remember for instance, that when I was at Brandeis as a graduate student, I had this amazing seminar with Susan Okin. And she became a really terrific mentor for me. And I was thinking about John Rawls and how he didn't talk enough about young people and their rights and so forth. But fast forward, I think, and Allison, correct me if I'm not remembering this correctly, but I remember having a conversation where I was talking to Allison about my interviews with a number of young undocumented immigrant rights activists, so-called Dreamers. And kind of work I've been doing on the Dreamer movement and the push towards DACA, and saying, you know, and part of that was my talking about how those young Dreamers came out and courageously put themselves on the line to try to not just get rights for themselves, but for their entire families. And Allison was relating a very similar story.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, in both of our sort of separate research arenas, ultimately, a lot of the questions that we were trying to answer, or a lot of the evidence that we were exploring, centered around young people in really pivotal ways. And then especially sort of the impact that these various political conflicts were having on young people, because they were being asked to sort of, you know, shoulder a lot of the burdens, right? All the sort of political debates ultimately fell downstream onto young people and you know, rested there. But I remember this one specific where I think when it gelled was we were, I think we were at a talk and there was some speaker, and I can't for the life of me remember what the talk was about, but I remember each of us separately brought up questions about young people as it pertained to this person's particular research project. And then both of us after the talk went outside of the room and, you know, huddled together. We were like, we need to write this book. Like, we need to be doing this because no one else is doing this. And we've already identified like three or four different areas, you know, between both of our separate research projects and then the questions that we had asked in this talk. We'd already set, you know, we had already identified like four separate spaces where young people were clearly pivotal and clearly ignored. And so we just realized like, we should do this. We need to be doing this. We need to be writing this book.
And one thing that shored it up was then we, you know, took over the whiteboard in the department meeting room and started like, you know, doing, because we love doing tables. We were doing tables and different categories and so forth. And then realized, by the way, that we were using a permanent marker.
Yeah, Sharpies.
So we found out from a few intrepid graduate students how to, you know, basically remove the evidence of our crime.
Well, the crime turned into a fascinating and extremely accessible, well-written book. And you talk about a number of things that you just mentioned a little bit as well, but certainly you lay out in the book that, first of all, political science doesn't pay a lot of attention to young people, and that oftentimes the youth are considered, as in a certain sense, citizens in waiting. So that the sort of time that one is a young person, either a child or an adolescent, is not necessarily something that politics hews in on, except as symbolic. And as sort of things that can be thrust forward as a sort of image. Can you talk about the absence of any real attention to this in political science? And it exists in other places and other disciplines, but why it's important that you brought this forward?
Sure, we definitely can. I would say first thing is that it's not that political scientists aren't thinking about young people or writing about them. And so, you know, one thing that we do in the book, for instance, is, you know, tip our cap at, you know, a pretty vast socialization literature that's been around for a while. Political psychology digs into this in really some prescient ways. And obviously political philosophy, whether you want to talk about Rousseau's Emile or, you know, a whole host of material. And then also public law will kind of also grapple in important ways with court cases that deal with kids. So I just want to kind of put that up front that we, you know, really recognize this earlier work and admire it and find it incredibly helpful to us. But yes, Lily, we find in the kind of ways that we're trying to think about young people in politics, which I guess we'll dig into in more depth in a few moments, and thinking about how they're governed, how they're weaponized or leveraged in our politics, and what their agency looks like, especially in movement politics and other forms of political activism, that could be attended much better, we think, by our discipline. And so that's what we're hoping to kind of address and help and kind of fill the lacuna that's really developed in that area.
And I would just to add like one other thing is, so I think one of the things that we both realized was that it's so when young people are the focal points of political science research, it's often, Lily, as you identified, which is, you know, citizens in waiting or, you know, future voters. And so what are the ways in which we can train or develop or understand, right, how young people think now so that when they matter, when they vote, we'll have some understanding of what they may or may not do. And then the other way to, that political science thinks about them is in these sort of discrete policy arenas, right? So we'll focus a lot on, right, dreamers, and then we'll focus a lot on the deployment of young people in the abstract, in the context of same-sex marriage or same-sex parenting, or more recently, you know, in the context of, you know, trans, you know, anti-trans and anti-gay school-based policies. But no one's really sort of threading the needle across these different policy arenas to suggest that young people are actually central in almost all political conflicts that we think about when we think about, you know, American political development and sort of landmark pivotal political moments in American politics. And that's what we were trying to set out to do, is to say, yes, they're really central in these particular policy arenas. And that's not happenstance, right? Like, that actually is because of some stuff that we would like to call attention to.
And in calling attention to the stuff, as it were, which is a broad sort of category, can we start also by talking about who you are classifying as young people? Because you do go through in the book and sort of talk about different age groups, and that individuals operate to some degree differently in, you know, the 0 through 7 group, or the, you know, the high schooler. So just a little clarity on how you came to the sort of understanding. Obviously there are, you know, census parameters and so forth, but who are we talking about when we're talking about young people?
Yes. So let me get this started, and then I will ask Allison to kind of finish up on it. So the first thing I think is really critical to have in mind is that the temporality of this is completely unclear. So even though you may have, you know, particular laws, when you can vote at 18, when you can drive at 16, when you can drink and so forth, are meant to provide, you know, crystal clear, you know, certainty on these kind of questions. The work of scholars like Martha Minow and Elizabeth Cohen and others, and a host of others, really captures just how murky it is, in fact, to pin down. And in fact, there's a whole politics swirling around when you define someone as a child or a youth as opposed to an adult. So whether it's criminal sentencing, when it is that you know, someone is given emancipation under the law, there's just a whole host of these things that are not very crystal clear at all. And so going back to that phrase that you started with, Lily, about citizens in waiting, you know, it would be nice, neat, and clean if we knew precisely when young people, at least from the perspective of the polis, instantly graduate from being, you know, in this probationary state to having, you know, amazing rational skills to be full-fledged citizens, when in fact it depends what category you're talking about, and it gets really, you know, in fact, ambiguous in that regard. So whether it's like parental consent for abortion and a variety of other issues, one of the things to be asking is, what are the capacities of young people in particular areas? And when is it that constraints on their freedoms to express themselves or to pursue their vision of the good is in fact justified? They don't ever want to go to bed, right? You know, what age? You said 0 to 7. Like, there's a lot of things where you would expect paternalism, as we classically understand it, to kick in. That is, where adults or other authorities, adult authorities, will impinge on the freedoms of a young person because it's in their best interest. But we have loads of examples of when the freedoms or the will of young people is constrained when it's not their interest. Think of child labor historically and today, but also lots of examples of when a young person is demonstrating enormous maturity, intellectual development, and self-determination to be able to do so. And that can be before the age of 18. And yet they are denied such, like freedom, certain forms of freedom of speech in schools and so forth. So that's where I would start.
Yeah. So I, we quickly realized as we were asking ourselves that question, I mean, and we bounced back and forth about like, well, maybe we should stop at high school or, you know, maybe we should, sort of move forward into college. My wife is a child psychiatrist and would argue that, you know, people who are in their early 20s are still, you know, sort of developmentally young people. And so we sort of went with that kind of, we leveraged that expertise and inched closer to college in terms of some of the stuff that we were looking at for sure. But I think one of the really cool things to come out of the project is really exploring how the concept of childhood is in and of itself a location of significant political conflict, right? And the fact that both the constraints of that concept and the benefits of that concept are, are sort of doled out in ways that are, really familiar. And if we look at the ways in which other sorts of benefits and constraints are doled out, by race, by gender, by policy context. And so the first substantive chapter in the book, I think, does a really great job of analyzing, how policy context, how demographics end up activating and troubling these conceptions of childhood, right? And creating a politics around the very notion of what it means to be a kid and what it means to benefit from that status and what it means to be constrained by that status.
And if you were going to do a quick survey in the book of, which young people are being discussed at length in our case studies or our key protagonists when we're describing them. So in our discussion of youth agency and social movements, from the civil rights movement to the March on Our Lives, we're talking about ages most often in the book from elementary school through teens, sometimes early 20s, but that usually is the group we talk about a lot. And then likewise, when we talk about when young people are kind of being leveraged in our politics, either kind of being weaponized or are important symbols and so forth, again, we're talking about from the very youngest ages through the early 20s. So that's kind of, it's a big range, but that's the set of folks who we end up focusing on in the book. And then depending on what laws, policies, or struggles we're talking about, we may be winnowing in on a particular age group when we do so.
And so my next question is, and you've sort of talked a bit about this, but right at the end of the introduction, you talk about the importance of centering children in the study of democratic politics as really sort of the investigation of what's going on in this book. And to some degree, why this group, this particular group of individuals is often seen at the periphery, but is in fact also oftentimes centerpieced, but without kind of agency. And so if you can explain a little bit about why, in particular, in the study of democratic politics, there is a need and importance to centering children. Allison, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, sure. Dan, did you want to? Oh, you want me to? Okay. Yeah. So, I think one of the main arguments or one of the main goals that we had for the book was to suggest, especially as political scientists, that folks weren't really fully understanding the important political moments, the important are important histories of democratic conflicts when they were ignoring young people, because so much of the ways in which those political moments played out in the way that they did because young people were centrally located in those spaces, right? And that they were either being deployed, we talk about being deployed as sort of armies, we talk about being deployed as symbols, we talk about ultimately young people becoming agents of change. And we talk a lot about the struggles, right, that take young people from being leveraged as images to catalyze adults, and then ultimately to coming to take over a lot of those social movements where they were serving adult interests, but ultimately took the reins themselves, and how, right, that transition of power was a really, really a critical focal point for those kinds of political conflicts. And so when we really sat down to think about, you know, these are all of the many areas where young people are such a pivotal location or such a pivotal role in each of these conflicts, we realized that they were really shaping the politics of that moment in really important ways that were being completely ignored in political science, such that we really didn't have a full understanding, a full grasp of both what was happening in those moments and then the implications of those moments, right? So we thought really seriously about how young people are really creating politics in really important ways. And then also at the same time, that politics and those policy spaces and those policy reforms and the conflicts around policy reforms and the conflicts around young people's role in those reform eras had really important implications for them, right? For young people in terms of their development, for young people in terms of their capacity to experience democracy in certain kinds of ways, for young people in terms of their, you know, transition from subjects of the polity, subjects of policy, into agents, you know, on their own behalf. And that turns out, especially right now, to have a huge importance, because I think our book can tell us a lot about what happened in the midterm elections, right? How Gen Z came to be, you know, came to play such an important role in this election specifically. I think we have a really important and I think highly accurate story to tell about that.
And just to amplify what Allison was saying, the book tries to proceed from a kind of a standpoint of young people being acted upon and being shaped or influenced by our democratic politics, and so the ways that they're governed, and so the extent to which they're being protected or subjugated or liberated or abandoned by a set of government policies, by school officials, by parents, and so forth. But then we proceed to thinking about how young people are being used in our democratic politics to serve a variety of different purposes, left, right, center. And then finally, as Allison said, thinking about the mobilization and independence of children, young people, as political activists in their own right. So those are kind of like the three moves we make throughout the book. And in each of those, I think it's of an integral importance to the nature of democratic politics. And in that, children or young people are at times dependent variables and other times independent variables, depending, you know, on, you know, in our democratic politics, in the sense that, as Allison said, they are being made by our politics, and they're also making a distinctive form of democratic politics.
And so I did want to ask you to talk a bit about some of the specific examples that you dive into throughout the book. Dan, you've already made reference in your introduction to sort of the way that DACA activists were at the forefront of the movement towards changing immigration status for those who came to the country when they were younger. But you also talk a lot about how younger people have been involved with regard to gun control control measures as a fascinating example and way in which, you know, we see it, but we don't necessarily think about it the way that you all have contextualized it. Can you take our listeners through a little bit of the examples and sort of kind of case studies that you use throughout the book to explain, you know, this question of leverage, this question of control, this question of agency, and how young people at different ages are part of that sort of taxonomy?
Let me start with one example, and then that I think is an interesting one that moves across the story of leveraging and takes us into agency. And actually, I'll give you two for the price of one by doing it two quick versions. One is, you know, from the civil rights movement, which I think many of your listeners know well, and it starts with the creation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and you know, clearly, and it originally organized by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. You had adults, kind of elders in the movement who were thinking about how to mobilize, you know, these energetic, not just college students, but also high school students and others in the movement. And so we get into a story about the creation of SNCC. We also talk about the critical role of the Children's Crusade and how in facing hoses and dogs and so forth, how young people were critical in that because they ran out of adults to put in prison. And also there were a lot of adults who did not want to actually, you know, step out. And so they found an incredibly energetic and resourceful set of kids who wanted to do it. And in that case, for instance, the principals of the school were told to lock the gates and the kids literally knocked the gates down. I mean, they like trampled over the gates to get out to face Bull Connor's dogs and so forth. So that's, you know, so example of, and by the way, there was a lot of very careful wrestling by adult civil rights leaders about the moral trade-offs of young people who would be, you know, children facing dogs and hoses were going to be far more sympathetic to the general public, as this was captured on video, than adults doing the same. And so, again, an example of kind of the power symbolism of young people. So fast forward, at a certain point, SNCC, these young activists, said, we actually don't agree with the agenda being set by elders in the movement. And we're going to go into Mississippi and organize people to vote. And those who are, you know, deeply steeped in the story of the long civil rights movement know well, you know, how significant the agency that emerged for SNCC and other youth in the civil rights movement ended up being strategically really crucial and took things in different directions than was expected. So different example, fast forward by several decades, and you have the Dreamers. And so in the 90s, early 2000s, you had seasoned immigrant rights lobbyists and leaders who recognized that one of the most sympathetic ways to bring about reform, that is to kind of draw lots of appeal with the general public for some kind of relief for undocumented immigrants living in the country, was to find star students, valedictorians and salutatorians and so forth, who were undocumented youth, also sports stars, those who were serving, you know, in young military training and so forth, you know, kind of get your best and brightest, most appealing youth who were undocumented in the country to be the faces of reform. And so they did an excellent job of recruiting people, young people to do this. They helped train them to come join each adult lobbyist in advocating for a Dreamer legislation on the Hill. And these young people became very effective as spokespeople, also on radio shows and TV interviews and so forth. And somewhere along the way, a significant portion of those young undocumented kids said, again, like SNCC, we don't agree with the elders. We actually want to take this a different direction. First of all, one of the slogans is, in essence, for Dreamer legislation is that you know, basically this was not our fault. They were brought here, not because of their own fault, but because they were brought along by their parents. And their perspective is, no, our parents were heroes who brought us here to rescue us from, you know, economic hardship, terror, violence, and so forth. And moreover, they also wanted to press reform at a time when, you know, older immigrant rights folks felt like they should compromise and go slower. So they pressed the issue. And the last thing I'll say really quickly on this then is that during the Obama administration, again, the more seasoned immigrant rights activists were saying, look, the Obama administration is on our side. They just can't get this through Congress. And Dreamers said, we need to take it to them. And in fact, we need to follow the model of the civil rights movement and create pressure from the outside. And so Obama became the deporter in chief. They confronted him during very high publicized public appearances and created all kinds of pressure that ultimately played a significant role in the administration going with DACA as an executive action that would address their needs. So we have these two different examples, SNCC and the Dreamers, that captures pretty powerful cases of emergent leadership where
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, I wanted to add one more to those, because I think those two are, you know, those two examples are two of the pillars of what got us started on the project and how we were thinking about not just young people and the role that they're playing, but also these sort of three discrete ways in which we think young people are functioning in the context of these political stories. And so what I want to tell just one more story, which speaks to the way that these things aren't linear, at least not in the way that they're laid out in the book, that sometimes you start with the leveraging, right, the iconography, and then sometimes that affects the agency, right, and then that sometimes results in control. And so we're writing, you know, an article or a couple articles right now that now start to tinker around with the model that we've created in the book, right, to show some of these dynamics. And so that's about the story of LGBTQ rights. So when you're thinking about gay rights and the kinds of, you know, leveraging, you know, instances of agency and then ultimately instances of control, you know, it's a really interesting story. Because what we talk about, you know, a great example of the leveraging of young people is, you know, it starts in the 1970s with Anita Bryant talking about, you know, gay people wanting to recruit young people and that becoming a really powerful tagline, you know, for an emerging Christian right coalition or Christian coalition and for an emerging sort of obsession with gay rights and young people. And so you see that tagline, right? They have to recruit our kids in like every single solitary decade leading up to today, right? It's hard to sort of escape that automatic knee-jerk reaction around gay people and children. But it ends up being deployed in this sort of abstraction of young people in order to prevent all sorts of progress towards gay rights. So in the 1970s, it's progress towards including sexual orientation in non-discrimination measures, in same-sex marriage. You know, fast forward, you know, 30 years, it becomes included in as reasons why we don't want gays to marry, because we don't want it to affect our kids at school. We don't want our kids at school to learn about the possibility of, you know, of being gay or being lesbian or being married. And again, we don't want it to, you know, we don't want the recruitment, right, to be sort of legitimized through the legitimization of marriage, right? So that's a textbook example of the leveraging of this sort of abstract youth, right, as being abstract victims to some abstraction of, you know, the predatory gay person, right? This is a pretty textbook, I think, deployment of young people. But then what happens is, you know, in the backdrop of that, you know, the sort of gay person being painted as the boogeyman and the sort of perennial young victim, right, to that gay predator, you've got young people, right, who are they themselves, you know, in school being bullied because of this rhetoric, right, because of this belief that they are predatory, right, or that, you know, or even self-hating, right, gay and lesbian young people who are self-hating, who don't want to come out of the closet because they're afraid, right, both of, right, these narratives being deployed against them, but then also, you know, internalizing some of them as well. And so in the 1990s, you know, in the 2000s, right, you see young LGBTQ folks in school starting to mobilize, starting to gain agency, and they mobilize around the creation of gay straight alliances, or what are now called gender sexuality alliances. They mobilize in terms of, you know, demanding rights for trans bathroom access in the, you know, in the sort of 2015, 16, 17 era after we have marriage equality legitimized, right? You see trans young people saying, okay, now we're going to step up trans rights because this is something that we need to be doing. And so you see young LGBTQ folks really taking the reins and launching their own kinds of demands in the political sphere through schools primarily, and really demanding a lot of attention and ultimately prevailing. I mean, you know, looking at from the 1990s to the early 2000s, the explosion of GSAs in campuses across the country is remarkable, right? And this is a purely youth-led movement that, you know, contested with a ton of backlash, but ultimately they prevailed. And so young people become this really powerful catalyst for change in the gay community and in the trans community. They become, you know, agents of their own policy reforms. And then what happens, right, is you get this, you know, immediate response and this immediate backlash in the form of control. And so what do you see happening now are, you know, the release of tons of anti-trans bills, you know, particularly those aimed not just at bathroom access, but in terms of athletics, right? And you see, you know, a number of states targeting trans youth, right? Actually targeting them specifically and saying that they can't, you know, they can't play on sports teams that match their gender identity, with a specific obsession with trans women on cis female sports teams. And then you also see the creation of these don't say gay bills, right? The bills that, you know, basically ban, you know, any books that mention, you know, sexuality or gender identity, any teachers who want to talk about curriculum that centers on sexuality or gender identity. And then in some states, you know, laws that say that you have to essentially report to all parents if there is somebody in the classroom who identifies as you know, gender fluid, or who identifies as gay or lesbian or bisexual or pansexual, or, you know, wherever on the spectrum that they sit. So you see this sort of, like, you know, element of, like, symbolic deployment of young people, kids taking over and saying, no, you know, not in our name. And then ultimately this sort of serious backlash against the very young people who've exerted some authority.
Dan, go ahead.
Lily, I was just to amplify this, just give me another quick example that you started with, which is, you know, as you noted, we, you know, spend a lot of time with the struggle over guns and the March for Our Lives movement. And it also captures very much, you know, this dynamic that Allison was sketching about youth activism mobilization then having a backlash, especially when it's viewed as having potency. And so the Parkland kids, for instance, that is, you know, the young people from Florida who helped launch this March for Our Lives movement become, you know, vilified. They become targets of, you know, pure fiction, because their message and their youth makes them a significant threat. And so we have lots of examples of that as well.
Yeah, I was really intrigued, unfortunately, by the research that you all found on this, in part because it does go to the sort of narrative conceptualization of the quote innocence of young people, and then in a context of their political engagement and activization, they are apparently no longer innocent or not allowed to be innocent. Can you talk about how, and it's narrative, right? It is really taking the sort of understanding of young people, in the way we craft this idea of childhood and adolescence, and then undermining it in terms of, oh, they're active in politics, so that means they're corrupt.
Mm-hmm. Another dynamic is our kids versus their kids. And so innocence has a lot to do with which kids one might be talking about. Ideally, it should be all young people. All young people should be viewed as having the same interests and welfare at stake, but obviously depends mightily on race, gender, class, sexuality, and a whole host of other issues or identities. And so like a quick example of this, again, can go back to the immigration debate, in which young people from the early 20th century, when we had this enormous and very expensive investigation about the impact of new immigrants from Southern Eastern Europe, made key distinctions between innocent and vulnerable kids from Northern and Western Europe facing the dangers of young people who are more prone to criminality, as claimed by eugenicists and others, coming from Southern Eastern Europe. Or if you look in the contemporary period, a long history from, you know, Steve King to Donald Trump and others who basically describe certain young people from below, from the Mexican border south, as posing significant threats in terms of criminality and drugs and so forth. And as such, then the innocence of and vulnerability of kids who were coming across the border, who then, as part of a family separation policy, during the Trump administration, become kids in cages. If it's framed in a certain way, is meant to become tolerable. And so it kind of goes to the heart of our political conflicts as a result.
Yeah. I'm going to just add one quick thing to that too, which is what you were just talking about, Dan, reminded me of a couple of other things in the book that I love, which is, you know, that like you said, you know, thinking about the our kids versus their kids and the ways in which only some kids get to be perceived as innocent. And so I think, you know, on the one hand, we're asking, you know, why don't all kids get to have that benefit? And on the other hand, we're also saying we're sort of calling BS a little bit on even the fact that that's a thing, right? That in fact, we don't really think about childhood as a time of innocence or as children as innocence that need to be protected, because there's like millions of examples where we don't do that. And we actually work really hard not to do that. Right. And so, in addition to, you know, thinking about, you know, young people who are othered in very explicit ways, right? I mean, we talk about Emmett Till, right? And the fact that, you know, he was entirely othered, and that even in the aftermath of his death, right, his grave ends up being desecrated in really horrible ways, right? Because he continues to be this this person who doesn't get to have childhood innocence, even after the horrible story is exposed. But then we also have these like insane moments where young people who were, you know, the victims of horrible crimes, or who were the unwitting participants in really violent moments, are accused of being liars, right? And so, like, you know, Sandy Hook is a great example. We talk quite a bit about you know, how they were accused of being actors and that they weren't actually real. And, you know, we know that to be true because, you know, similar to Emmett Till, their graves have been desecrated in really horrible ways. And then you also go back to, you know, the famous photograph from Kent State, right, of the young woman who's you know, standing by the student who was shot, and how she was also accused of being a liar, right? She was accused of being an actress, or she was also accused of, you know, not being a kid or being an adult, right? Her whole life was sort of completely upended, right? Because she had the misfortune of being in that space in that moment. And so the kids are not allowed to be innocent when they don't either comport with the expectations of certain kinds of political communities, and neither are they allowed to be innocent if they are not part of a very specific kind of privileged demographic.
And the great divide on that actually can be seen even in the history of childhood itself. And we delve a bit into this in the book about when do we start seeing the use of the phrase childhood or thinking about that. And it's really deeply connected late 19th, early 20th centuries with, you know, privileged families who begin to, you know, dote on their kids and, you know, provide toys and certain leisure and certain ways of thinking about the protection and welfare of young people for those privileged children. When at the very same time, we, you know, as all of our legal eagles know out there, we had cases like Dagenhart where, you know, the court was saying, yeah, these kids can be contracted for harsh labor in textile plants and coal mines and so forth, and to hell with their welfare.
Yeah, we were actually just talking about Dagenhart in my class on con law last week. So, yep, with you on that one. I wanted to ask you a little bit about a sort of way that you sort of set things up in terms of understanding how children are governed, which you mentioned earlier on. But it is something that comes into a lot of the analysis in terms of these. They're constraints most of the time, and to some degree they may come into conflict with a certain amount of agency. But you talk about paternalism, subjugation, membership, and abandonment as kind of the categories of how they're governed, and how you know, I constantly keep having this conversation in my political theory class about how my children are my property, and so we have a regular sort of round of that in political theory. So if you could talk a little bit about this sort of way that we often categorize young people, not just children, but young people, and how that, you know, contributes to also the way that young people become symbols as opposed to actual beings.
Absolutely. So there's two variables we think about in this regard to create those four categories. One is to think about laws, policies, practices that are either in the child's best interest or in someone else's interest. And then the second variable we think about is control or intervention versus autonomy for the child or young person. And so when you think about those kind of, you know, those binaries, then you end up with these four groups. So paternalism is that classic category, right? Ronald Dworkin and a whole host of others who, you know, provides a good definition, which is that there is control being exercised by the state or other adults on behalf of the child's best interest. And there might be arguments about that, but you know, the intention there is, you know, is a critical component of it. So it's everything from compulsory education to child labor protection, since we did eventually get that, going back to the Dagenhart case, to, you know, the child health insurance program, things like that. And then you get these examples of when there's interventions or controls that have nothing to do with the child's interest. So that gets to your children as property. That gets to Reuben Dagenhart. So there's, you know, child labor, efforts, for instance, to get like gay therapy, where, you know, a young person is being forced into something that someone else is telling them is in their interest, but we know from all the research and we know from the lived experience that it's horrendous, right? And so then a third category is when there's autonomy granted to the young person, and it's potentially in their best interest. So we can think of examples of free speech, or religious liberty, or due process rights, and so forth, where a young person being able to exercise that level of membership, of entitlement, is, you know, can be very powerful. In, you know, reproductive choice is another example. Driver's licenses, since I have a son who's 17, he would say that's one of those. And then the final category is when basically you have laws and policies, regulations and so forth, that are in the interest of others, not the child's interest, and also engage with kind of autonomy, which is kind of an issue of abandonment. And so that can be parent-initiated emancipation, racial disparities in how, in terms of the trying of children as adults. And so those are some examples. I would love, and Allison, if you could talk about the flip sides of these, yeah. I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think one of the, you know, and one of my favorite things about writing this book was, like, in writing it, we were like, oh my gosh, that's a brilliant point that we just made. Like, and one of those, you know, one of those things was exactly when we did this, you know, 2x2. And we were able to look at the membership versus abandonment, you know, the sort of flip sides of those things to really see, you know, how this operates. And so one of the great examples of membership, you know, is child emancipation, right? So when you're looking to be an emancipated minor, either because you want to make your own health care choices, or, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, a pregnant teen who, you know, strangely can't rent, you know, a home for herself, but has the power to, you know, provide, you know, a whole range of sort of adult decision-making on behalf of her unborn, unborn child, or, you know, ultimately when the child is born. And so she's in this, like, strange place where she can be a parent to her child, but she actually can't make decisions on her own behalf. And so, you know, has to get emancipated so she can actually sign a rental agreement to get a house. And so, right, there's a way in which there's a version of emancipation that is really about, young people want to be, you know, want to have membership, right? Want to be adults, you know, need to be adults, are asking to be granted that level of autonomy. But the flip side of that, right, is abandonment, which is where young people are being foisted into, right, being forced into a space where essentially the state and the polity has given up on them, right? And so these are young people who, you know, the criminal justice system is a great example, right, where you have a larger percentage of Black youth who are ultimately tried as adults, because, you know, when they're tried as adults, right, the sentencing options are much, much different. And so that's a situation where the state is saying, we are no longer going to protect you, right, with the benefits of youth. And so we are foisting you, not because it serves your purposes, but because it serves our purposes, to not have to treat you like a child, right, but to instead abandon you and set you free in this sort of unregulated adult space. And what I love about the flip sides of those is that it really shows, A, that there's a policy context for these things, but that B, there's a very clear set of disparities, right? That certain kinds of communities and certain kinds of children and how those categories of exclusion that we, you know, that we know to be true operate both among adults, but then also clearly among young people in really interesting and problematic ways.
And so this is a really important and missing book. So I'm glad that it exists to fill in spaces and places where there hasn't been appropriate or substantial research, particularly in political science. So I know that the two of you are continuing to work on this topic. Can you talk just a little bit about the direction that some of this research is going?
I can get us started. So this wasn't actually supposed to be the first book. We gave you a little bit of a glimpse of our expertise. You know, we actually thought what we would be doing initially is to write a book that was organized around three or four case studies in which one could really get a sense for these issues of control and leverage and agency, but within particular cases. So, you know, to track the long civil rights movement on this, for instance, to dig into the immigration, the struggles over immigration politics, and particularly what the role young people have played, both in kind of earlier, you know, so before the Dreamer movement, but kind of in earlier periods of immigration reform politics, to dig into the struggle surrounding LGBTQIA rights and mobilizations. So we were going to do, basically, we were in a case selection phase where we had like six or seven of these, and we're just saying, which of these do we want to focus in on and to do what we like to do, which is lots of, you know, careful archival research, interviewing, looking carefully at the legal cases and the narratives and so forth, and to basically tell those stories and then, you know, provide some great analytical punchlines. But as we were on the way there, we were looking for a book like Democracy's Child that would help set the foundation for us. And we're like, wait, at least for us, the concepts and theoretical insights that we were looking for weren't there. So that's what ended up leading us to write this. So I think at least one of the first things we'd like to do is get back to that book where we really provide some compelling case studies in this area.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, and then there's also, you know, I think that now that we're, you know, a couple steps removed from what we did, we can start to see some of the really cool implications of setting up the narrative in this way. And so now we're like, ooh, you know, we can actually now tell a story about, you know, the dynamics of moving from, you know, being a symbol of politics to being an agent of your own, you know, political agenda. And that's a cool story, right? Or now we can really tell a story about those flip sides, right? And the ways in which, you know, these sort of categories of membership and abandonment are deeply tied to the same kinds of struggles around identity and exclusion that we see in a lot of other areas of American politics. And so that's a cool article that we can write too. So we're sort of in this like amazing space where we created the book that we thought existed but didn't exist that could allow us to sort of springboard from it. So now that that book is out there, now we're doing the springboarding in the form of these articles, and then also setting our sights on this book that really does a deeper dive into these particular political moments.
One other really quick thing I'd mention is this project also radicalized us as we were writing. And that takes a lot because we're both radicals to begin with.
Yeah.
But on this issue, and, you know, we both love and we use in our classes Robert Dahl's work. But, you know, we have this quote in our conclusion where he says, "No one seriously contends that children should be full members of the demos that governs the state." And in fairness, Dahl has a, you know, kind of very careful qualification about why he thinks that. And it goes back to the whole idea of citizens in waiting, and you don't want, you know, these young members of society who don't have full capacities yet to participate. But for us, we're like, we're not sure we agree. In fact, we know we don't agree. And it goes back to actually one of the things where we started, Lily, where you were asking about, you know, what are, like, you know, the crystal clear ages of such and such. And so, you know, I'm not sure where I would have stood if you asked me what should be the voting age when I started this project. I probably would have said, well, 18 sounds about right, maybe 17. But I have a much more capacious view of that now than I ever did. And in all sorts of areas, it makes me question where we limit the agency, particularly the political agency of young people who have demonstrated that oftentimes they're more the adults in the room than the so-called adults. That is, they're showing far more wisdom and concern for the common good than a lot of much older citizens.
That's right. That's right. You know, and ultimately are having to pay the costs in a much more pronounced way. So, you know, it sort of doesn't make sense. You know, if they're going to be deployed as in the way that they are, then they should be able to have a voice in those very spaces in which they're deployed.
Yes. My students were asking me the other day why it is that in Wisconsin, a young person can drink alcohol if their parent buys it for them when they're 16. And so on. Yeah.
There are tons of examples like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Like, I don't have an answer for you, but
keep asking those questions. Yeah.
So I want to thank Dan Tischner and Allison Gash for joining me today to talk about Democracy's Child, Young People, and the Politics of Control, Leverage, and Agency. And this is published by Oxford University Press. I assume one can buy it at the Oxford University Press website. Is there a brick and mortar store to which you would like to give a shout out?
Well,
I don't know. I don't know. Are there brick and mortar stores that are selling them? I'm not sure. I know
Amazon.
Amazon has it for sure. Powell's has it on their website for sure, and may even have it in their stores as well. Yeah.
Thank you. We'll direct people to Powell's or to the Oxford University Press website.
We'll go to Powell's.
We love Powell's. You can spend a great day at Powell's anytime.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Allison.
Yep.